Foundation at macfound.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. And then later on, we'll open up the phone lines and take your phone calls, too. And we can talk about some of the issues raised during the show that we're about to hear. We'll also talk about some other items in the news that are not mentioned on the TV show. This is a TV show that I do that features usually two journalists and a Republican and a Democrat. And we band around some of the big issues that have taken place in Florida in the past 7 days. So here we go with Florida This Week. As you're listening to this, please email us your thoughts about the topics. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org. That's dj@wmnf.org. Coming up next, even before Hurricane Irma, an audit showed Florida's emergency response system was not ready for the next disaster. The St. Petersburg City Council votes to limit corporate campaign funding in the city. Both Christman and Baker are now raising record amounts for their mayoral campaigns. And security will cost $500,000 when a white supremacist speaks this coming week at the University of Florida. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
From the WEDU studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lurie.
Welcome back. This week our panelists are Ernest Hooper is a columnist for the Tampa Bay Times and host of That's All I'm Saying here on WEDU. Noel Pransky is an investigative reporter for 10 News WTSP. Cheryl Wilson is the chair of the Manatee County Democratic Party. And Danny Alvarez is an attorney and a Republican. Great to have you here. Thank you for coming. Well, long before Hurricane Irma ripped through the state, Florida's Division of Emergency Management issued a warning. The state was ill-prepared for a major disaster. An audit by the agency's inspector general found that food and water supplies were inadequate at the state's distribution center in Orlando. The agreements many trucking companies had signed to distribute food statewide had expired. And the spreadsheet that would be used to predict the amount of supplies and equipment needed in a hurricane emergency had not been updated since the 1980s. There were reports of a shortage of shelters and of food and water at evacuation centers, but the state's interim emergency management chief, 29-year-old Wesley Maul, said no county requests or needs went unmet during Hurricane Irma. Maul's career includes little experience in emergency management. He worked at a mattress store in Gainesville, graduated from law school 4 years ago, and worked as a travel aide during the governor's reelection campaign in 2014. So, Ernest, this audit warned us that we weren't quite prepared. We came through it fairly well here in Florida as opposed to what happened in Puerto Rico. But what do you think this audit says about, what happens next?
Well, the most alarming aspect was not just the audit, but the response to the audit. And it said in the story that they gave themselves a deadline of 18 months to get everything corrected. Now, I guess they had a lot to get corrected, but we're approaching another hurricane season. You can't take 18 months to get these issues resolved when you know the potential of a major hurricane striking our state is so great. And so that was very striking to me. The other thing that stood out, of course, is the questionable experience of Wesley Maul, the former mattress salesman. But I really feel like with Governor Scott running for the U.S. Senate next year, he can't afford to have a major catastrophe in terms of emergency management. So he must have some degree of faith, or a lot of faith, I would hope, in his appointee. And I would have to think this is more than just a political favor. If it's not, he's taking a calculated risk in terms of his Senate campaign.
No, there's still some lingering problems from Hurricane Irma. That is the cleanup in South Florida. The governor goes to Washington, D.C. this week, and gets into a fight with Debbie Wasserman Schultz over the pace of cleanup in South Florida. Also, there's a problem of workforce housing in the Keys, where a lot of mobile homes are destroyed. Now, where do those folks that work in the hotels and, you know, working in the fishing industry, where do they stay? Where do they live? We still have some lingering problems.
We had a lot of damage in the Keys, for sure. And the Keys traditionally have been a very difficult place to get business done for contractors, things like that. It's expensive to build down there because no matter, even in good conditions, it's hard to get equipment and supplies and contractors down there. So we knew the Keys were going to take a while. What we didn't expect was this debris issue, which Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the governor went head-to-head on. And just this past couple days, we saw CBS 4 down in Miami released a report showing that the governor himself, his office really issued an RFP for debris removal that was up to 10 times the cost of what the traditional municipalities were paying for these things. So you have governments competing against each other for these services. It's not going terribly well in that regard, but we should give credit at least to the governor for running a pretty good hurricane. As Ernest said, he needs good political points in the next year.
I like that term, running a pretty good hurricane.
So things could have gone a lot worse. Yeah. In my mind, the biggest thing moving forward may not be that these contracts that the state has to, that the audit exposed the state doesn't have in place moving forward. It's the fact that Florida doesn't have a disaster contingency fund. And right now, the biggest lingering issue moving forward may be the budget. You know, this was, by all accounts, a moderate hurricane. If it had been bigger, how is Florida going to pay for that? We're one of the few states that doesn't have a contingency fund to pay for disasters. Insurers have it, municipalities have it. Our state doesn't. How are we going to pay for these
and
things?
And it's also blasted a hole in the coming year's fiscal budget.
And it will for many years.
Right. And don't you wonder when the previous audit was? How frequently is this audit conducted? You know, when I hear that a spreadsheet is from the 1980s, again, I know from working in that field that we had them updated in the 90s and the early 2000s.
And Jeb Bush promised a culture of preparedness. I mean, he knew when he was governor that we were facing this kind of disaster.
We adopted, the state of Florida adopted a couple of programs in the early 2000s. One was before the 2004-2005 active season. Another one was right after it, in response to it. And I see no evidence of those programs in what we've seen in the last few years.
Danny, I want to ask about the head of the state emergency department. He was a campaign aide to Governor Scott. He has just a little bit of experience. He's a young guy, 29 years old. He's the interim director of emergency operations here in Florida. How much confidence do you have in him?
I would be very satisfied if they made him the permanent director. Having worked with Wes, I know him to be a man who is both competent and intellectual, and to say he was a travel aide really minimizes his position of both confidence and responsibility in the governor's office and in the governor's inner circle.
What's his experience dealing with emergencies?
I have no idea what his experience, from an emergency management perspective, I don't know. From what I read, it's not deep. But that's not the tale here, right? Well, the tale here is leadership. And what we've seen him do is rise to the occasion on more than one time, even when the decision-making paradox was unfavorable to our side, he did the right thing all the time. So that's what I'm looking for when I see these things. And, you know, I've gotten out of politics, really, and I've gotten back into the business world, but I've still kept track of what's going on the inside, and you can see he's doing really good things. I have a lot of confidence. I know he was a mattress salesman. Listen, I sold comic books my first job, you know what I mean? Because that would make me unfit to be an attorney, but some would argue maybe it really fit. I don't know.
And maybe it's unfair to compare unfair. Him to a Craig Fugate, but I'm very aware that Craig Fugate's spent 10 years as a county emergency management director before he moved into the state job. And before he was a county emergency management director, he was a first responder. So he was in that world. He was in that field. And he was moving.
He used to
quickly.
Have this job, and he's kind of considered to be the gold standard of all the heads
of
emergency here in Florida.
Yes, and then he went to FEMA during the Obama years.
I wouldn't want to have Wes's job or responsibility. That's a big thing. The question is, can he do it, and is there faith that he can? I think that he can. We have, you know, lots of folks in the military who are at 29, they're running people into battle left and right, and we're counting on them to bring them home. Can they do it? We never say, hey, they're 29. We say, are they capable? Yeah. Wes is capable.
Right, it's just the bottom line. This. So the governor, you think, needs to take a look at this audit and kind of, like, carry out the kind of...
In the wake of Irma, we certainly need to be proactive in terms of our preparation for the next hurricane. And let's face it, we went a long time without being struck by a major hurricane. Complacency clearly settled in. I'm guilty of it in my own home. I did not have the proper number of Pop-Tarts in the pantry.
But you promise to get them now?
But yes, we have 72 on hand right now. So all of us as Floridians have to take a look at how we get prepared and do a better job and be ready for the next one and not assume that it's going to be another 5 or 6 years before we're struck again.
All right. Well, last week, the St. Petersburg City Council became the first government body in the nation to vote to limit contributions to political action committees.
The council voted 6-2 to put a limit of $5,000 a year on the amount of money an individual can give to PACs involved in city elections. It also requires more extensive disclosure by donors. The council majority wants to limit the influence of wealthy interests in local elections. It's a direct challenge to the controversial Supreme Court Citizens United decision that removed restrictions on how much outside groups can spend to influence elections. Backers hope it will become a model for the nation and eventually lead to a new Supreme Court decision on campaign donations. But opponents think the limits will not be okayed by the conservative U.S. Supreme Court and will lead to costly legal battles for the city of St. Petersburg.
All right, Danny, is it a good idea to put limits on contributions to political action committees in St. Petersburg?
I'll ask you, is it a good idea to limit the First Amendment? We're around some First Amendment practitioners, right?
So does money equal speech?
Does access to your own voice, whether it's corporate or individual, matter? The Supreme Court says that it's blind to that, right? You can have a corporate voice, and that this action here by the city council is just a direct reaction to that. You know, there's been a clamor against Citizen United, and so it's interesting to see that St. Pete, you know, it's right in our backyard. It's a little job security for these folks because it's going to be a great story going on. It's not going away. It's going to be challenge after challenge. I don't see it going a lot of places. We've had this discussion a little bit, and I don't think it's going to hold up, but I think that's the point. I think they want to make the question come, and they want someone to make a hard decision to be on the record.
Is St. Petersburg in store for a lot of legal bills as a result of this vote?
I wasn't there, but I would be a little shocked if their attorney wasn't like, guys, seriously, we can't afford this. We're going to need a PAC to help us fund this. You know what I mean? So it's going to be expensive unless, of course, they just drop it when they lose their will when the next city council comes around.
The groups behind it say they're going to help St. Pete defend it if it comes to that.
That was going to be my point. I believe the groups that are so anti-Citizens United have come forward and said that they will support
that.
What
do you think about this idea that money equals speech? Should money equal speech?
I believe in the personal level, it should. I'm not sure that I would go that far in the corporate level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think, Noah? Do you think that there's going to be much of a challenge to this decision by the St. Pete City Council, and will they be able to get it all the way to the Supreme Court and then get a positive decision?
You know, it's funny, when you have a case you think is destined for higher courts, little things can derail
right.
it. Mm-hmm. It takes years and years to find that perfect case to go to the state Supreme Court even, let alone the federal Supreme Court. So it's impossible to predict if this will go all the way up the chain, but I think the St. Pete Council is ready to buckle in and go to war over that. I think they're ready to spend some money. City of St. Petersburg has a lot of things they want to spend some money on, sewers, stadiums, things like that. So they're going to have to pick and choose at some point. It could get expensive. But at the end of the day, you ask, is money equal speech? You need legal experts to determine that, but I can tell you, an investigative reporter knows money equals influence. And at the very base of this, St. Pete City Council, give them credit for trying to limit the outside influence on their elections.
Well, that is what they're trying to do, Ernest.
Yeah, the question isn't, does money equal speech? The question is, what is the most fair and appealing election process for the general voter, and not necessarily the huge corporation or the well-moneyed supporter? What's best for our everyday citizens? And I think when you look at it through that prism, there are some real questions about Citizens United. And I don't know how this is going to turn out. It is a risk for the city council to try this, but we're living in a different era politically. And this is another sign of that.
That's
we're living in a completely different era, and we're going to see different kinds of challenges.
What's the sense of the table here? Do you think that the ordinary voter out there is concerned about unlimited campaign contributions and wants to put limits on them? Or do they see Citizens United as a beacon of free speech, and that is, here's a way that if people have money, they can influence politics, but we don't have a problem with that. I mean, are voters upset at the amount of money in politics, and do they want it limited?
I've never met anyone who's happy with the amount of money in politics, and I've never met anyone who wishes there was more other than politicians.
All right. Well, and speaking of big money in elections, both Rick Baker and Rick Christman have together raised nearly $2.5 million in their race for mayor of St. Petersburg, making this the most expensive race in city history.
Their total cash haul could very well exceed $3 million by the November 7th election, according to the Tampa Bay Times. Some recent big donations, the Tampa Bay Rays donated another $50,000 to Christman. Meantime, Republican State Senator Jeff Brandis of St. Petersburg has donated more than $100,000 to Baker's campaign through his Liberty Florida PAC. And last month, Baker's PAC, Seamless Florida, received a $50,000 donation from Conservative Principles for Florida. That's a PAC in Coral Gables controlled by State Representative Jose Oliva. He's a Miami Lakes Republican who wants to become House Speaker in 2019.
So, Noah, money is pouring into this race. Why? And is this unusual, or do you think this is just the way mayoral races are going to go in major cities around the state?
Money is access. Money is influence. And you look at, take the Tampa Bay Rays, for instance, who have now given more than $80,000 to Mayor Rick Christman. Well, he's already offered them tens of millions of dollars in subsidies. I mean, $80,000, if he gets reelected, is money very well spent for them. On the other side, you've got Bill Edwards funding huge amounts of cash to what is right now his employee, Rick Baker. But if Bill Edwards plans on staying in St. Pete a long time and Rick Baker were to win, they're going to have a lot of business interaction.
Parse that out. When you say that that Christman is giving the Rays a promise of subsidies, parse that out a little bit more.
So Mayor Christman has already indicated if he's reelected, he is open to giving them tax dollars. We know the county is open to giving bed tax dollars. And the mayor's already said also he's willing to share redevelopment rights, which currently, after 2027, the city owns redevelopment rights to all of the acreage at Tropicana Field. He's saying, we're willing to give you half of all redevelopment rights, which could be tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, to the team if they stay. So that's his opening negotiation. Mm-hmm. We would expect if the Rays decide to stay in St. Pete, the city to probably have to open their pocketbooks even more. And that includes general revenue dollars. So the Rays have a lot at stake in this mayoral election.
Mm-hmm. All right, Danny, big money in this race. Why do you think so much money is pouring in? And I got to say, a lot of that money looks partisan. I don't know if that's what the way you see it.
It's absolutely. It's a battle of the bay. And so it is St. Pete coming into their own. So we've always talked about, you know how the feathers get ruffled when we call it Tampa Bay? Yeah. Well, it's really St. Pete is finally finding its prominence, but might not be the way we like it, but the indicators are money is funneling in because of the importance of St. Petersburg in general to the entire corridor. So they're going to be the anchor of the corridor. We were talking about, is it going to go red or is it going to blue? It's a fight every single time, and it's really, really important, and the money proves that.
All right. Does it set St. Pete up? Let's say the Republicans win this.
Right.
What happens? What are the bragging rights, or what's the significance of the Republicans win this mayoral race?
Well, we're just hopscotching, right? So we have one city that's red, one city that's blue, and let's see what happens the next time. This will be battleground 101 for the foreseeable future until we become either the second or first most populous state in the union, and from immigration that's coming north, from north to south, and they might bring a more liberal tendency when at that point the fight is over, right? So right now, red is just trying its best to hold on and win strategically where it can in the urban area.
Ernest, a few months ago... Well, go ahead.
I was going to say municipalities are the last stronghold
right.
of the Democratic Party. They've lost a majority in the state legislature. They haven't had it for 20 years. They haven't had the governor's mansion for that long. So clearly, if the Republicans can gain control of municipalities, game over. They're controlling the whole state. And I think not only are they eager to win some of these mayoral races across the state, but if they aren't able to win them, there are going to be some policies that make it more difficult for counties and municipalities to operate. We have seen some of that this year, particularly with the homestead exemption. If that increases, it's going to take a huge chunk of money out of the budgets for municipalities across the state.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, I don't know if this happens in Manatee County or Bradenton, but let me pop it to you. That is that the complaint here by some is that it's a local race and you shouldn't turn it into a partisan race. And especially there's been a lot of criticism directed at Rick Christman for trying to nationalize the race and tying Rick Baker to Donald Trump. But is it fair to have these local races for mayor turn partisan? And what do you think about the strategy to nationalize
it? It absolutely happens in Manatee County, and we hear that just as it is up here north of the bridge. By statute, I think all municipal elections in Florida are nonpartisan races, but the voter tends to know the party alignment of the players. What I notice in this St. Pete race is the very heavy influence of the Florida legislative delegation in it. And that's what we stress all the time, is that that legislative controls so much of our ability to influence. It's controlling our congressional districts. It's controlling the different county commissions that are drawn and districted and gerrymandered. So, yeah, the partisanship plays very heavily in it.
All right. Well, the University of Florida says the bill to provide security for a speech by white nationalist Richard Spence this coming week will total more than $500,000.
Spencer is president of the National Policy Institute. That's a white supremacist think tank. He advocates ethnic cleansing to create a whites-only homeland. Spencer was also the architect of the far-right protest in Charlottesville that left one anti-fascist activist dead. He's renting speaking space at UF's Phillips Center this coming Thursday afternoon. The University of Florida campus police are expecting protests. They're banning a wide range of items from parts of the campus on that day, including bicycles, water bottles, bike locks, umbrellas, purses, and backpacks.
So originally Spencer was turned down by the university, but he challenged it along with a liberal attorney and got the right to speak on the campus. But what do you think Richard Spencer stands for?
I don't think there's any question what Richard Spencer stands for, and he proudly stands for it. He's a white supremacist. He's a racist. He's a Nazi sympathizer. This one is painful for me. I am also a Gator. I was in Gainesville Saturday, and I said to too many people probably what a great environment that city and that campus is, and it pains me to think that someone who espouses that hatred is going to come onto that campus. But this is where you do the character check and you do the conscience check, and I have spent the last 3 or 4 weeks defending the right of people to take a knee to protest something that is strong to them. So I'm not going to go of the position that the University of Florida should not have allowed him to come in there. I do hope, as the president of the university did, and I will give Marco Rubio a lot of credit for saying, stay away, don't give him a platform, don't give him an opportunity to reach the students and to represent Florida in this way. And I think that if we confront what this man and his movement stands for, we're going to be stronger in the end of it. And sometimes we do just have to acknowledge that it's there and move on from that.
What do you think, what's the scenario by which Spencer wins, and what's the scenario by which the anti-fascist or the anti-Nazi groups win? Give us a scenario.
If there's a violent conflict, I think Spencer wins. It draws more media attention. It highlights his message. It helps him get the word out. I know people will want to protest, but in the end, I think it's best to have an anti-Spencer rally somewhere else on the campus, away from where he's speaking, and really just try to ignore him and draw the attention away from him. If you have another rally with more students and more people, the media would be drawn to that instead of being drawn to a conflict between protesters.
No, what do you think? And also, what do you think about that bill? I mean, the campus police say the security bill is going to be $500,000.
Yeah, so for comparison, when Pastor Terry Jones threatened to burn the Quran back on September 11, 2010, we had similar kind of lead up to this. You know, huge outrage, people threatening to come into the state, protests and all those things that were possibly turning violent. The bill for that was $180,000. This is three times that, because I think Alachua County and Gainesville are scared of this becoming Charlottesville. So they're doing everything they can do to try and prevent that. Unfortunately, the school isn't allowed to bill that back. Terry Jones was billed back by the public authority because it wasn't on a campus. Mm-hmm. However, the Supreme Court in the early 90s said speech cannot be financially burdened.
Are they going too far? Bicycles, purses, backpacks being banned?
No, I think it actually probably does everything it can do to discourage people from coming there and making it difficult to do things that would make this a bad experience.
You have a student population, but you also have a work population there. It's a huge work population there that they have to provide a safe workplace for that.
Okay. Well, before we go, what other news stories should we be paying attention to? Noah, let's start with you.
This weekend, 10 Investigates is about to launch a project on our website. Check it out. It will be a two-year later look back at our investigation into Hillsborough County Board of Commissioners. They weren't doing the right things when it came to public records. We showed how close relationships with lobbyists and other political allies were. Texts were getting deleted, emails weren't being turned over, and those things. So the county, as a result, issued a new policy that all county commissioners had to use county-owned phones. 2 years later, none of them are doing it, and we're showing how public records, once again, getting jeopardized. And some of the reactions we got from commissioners are pretty appalling.
How about that? Danny, your other big story.
Mine's not as intense. Bodily injury is actually going to probably pass the legislature. It's got a great chance. That's the requirement that everyone carries a bodily injury insurance. It sounds boring, but it has really big impacts both for the insurance industry, the lawyers, and most importantly, the people that get hurt every single day on these streets.
All right. Cheryl, your other big story.
I'm going to go just south of Manatee County. A Sarasota County district in the state legislature has a vacancy that has suddenly arisen when a young Republican woman legislator was pressured to leave her legislative post. It cleared up a spot on the ballot in Manatee County because it allowed the son of our Congressman Vern Buchanan, who is running for now that legislative seat in Sarasota County, to drop out of a race in Manatee County, allows another young Republican white male to run almost unopposed in that Manatee County race. And the chair of the Republican Party and the Donald Trump spokesperson in the Sarasota County Republican Party is the third in the triumvirate. Mm-hmm. Lots of games being played, as we said, in that legislative situation.
Is that Sarasota seat a pretty safe Republican seat?
It is not. Yeah. It leans Republican, but the advantage is not great, and there are two very credible candidates running in the Democratic primary there.
All right, Ernest, your other big story?
Well, I'll piggyback on what she said. We had a House primary here this week, and Yvonne Fry, who has been out there representing Plant City, lost by 10 points to her male opponent. It was somewhat surprising given that he hadn't been as active in the community. He didn't have a very good individual voting record in terms of just being engaged in politics. And it really makes me wonder how much gender played a role in how that election turned out. And I do get a sense that not only are we seeing Republicans become more dominant, but Republican white males become more dominant.
All right. Well, thank you all for a great show. And thanks for watching Florida This Week.
That was Florida This Week from this past Friday night. And people are already emailing about that show. You can email your comments about what you've just heard to dj@wmnf.org. And my guests were Danny Alvarez, who's a local attorney and a Republican, Ernest Hooper is a columnist and editor at the Tampa Bay Times. Noah Pransky is an investigative reporter at 10 News WTSP. And Cheryl Wilson is chair of the Manatee County Democratic Party. And we talked about whether or not Florida is well prepared for the next hurricane. I just saw a story that says that Puerto Rico is still 85% without electricity. But we talked about whether or not Florida is well prepared for the next hurricane. We also talked about the effort by the St. Pete City Council to ban some contributions to political action committees. And we talked also about the St. Pete mayor's race and the upcoming visit of a white supremacist to the University of Florida campus. Let me read some of the emails that have come in. You can call us up, too, if you want to talk about some of the issues that were raised on that program. The phone number is 813-239-9663. Frank Knox is our phone producer today. So Suzanne writes this: I commend the St. Pete City Council vote. All change has to start somewhere. I'm tired of big corporations choosing our Congress and our president. I thought it was for the people, not for the corporations. So there's a yay to what the St. Pete City Council did two Thursdays ago. And then Tony writes this: the Tampa Bay Times has strongly endorsed Rick Baker and has headlined their complaint that Christman has nationalized the mayoral contest by making Trump an issue. And Tony goes on to write, by not allowing that there is any distance between him and our national outrageously unqualified would-be dictator in these perilous times, Baker has shown himself unfit to lead a middle-sized city with a growing progressive bent. That's Tony's email. And here's an email about the speaker on the University of Florida campus, the white supremacist, this Thursday. Bowen writes this, he should have to pay for the security, if for nothing more than his hatred. Come on, people, love one another. Everybody get together, try to love one another right now. There's a Bowen quoting from the Youngbloods. All right, let's open up the phone lines. I'm going to suggest a few news stories that we could talk about, things that have happened in the past few hours, and then let's see where we head in this conversation. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And here are some of the things that I think that we could talk about. Lawyers for one of the women who have accused Donald Trump of sexual assault subpoenaed his campaign for all documents relating to her, all communications with or about her, and all documents concerning any woman who asserted that Donald J. Trump touched her inappropriately. This comes in the case of Summer Zervos, a former contestant on The Apprentice TV show, who accused Trump of sexually abusing her, of assaulting her in 2007. Trump has denied the claims. The subpoena issued in March is just coming to light now and is part of a defamation lawsuit filed by Zervos in New York State. The Trump lawyers said in a court motion, Ms. Zervos does not and cannot state a cause of action for defamation under California law, which applies here because Ms. Zervos is domiciled and was purportedly injured there. The allegedly defamatory statements were made during a national political campaign that involved heated political debate in political forums. Statements made in that context are properly viewed by courts a part of the expected fiery rhetoric, hyperbole, and opinion that is squarely protected by the First Amendment. That's the statement from Trump's lawyers about this subpoena of records involving an alleged sexual assault of a contestant of Trump's TV show. And then her lawyers, Ms. Zervos' lawyers, said, contrary to defendant's spin, this case is not about robust political debate. Ms. Zervos was not a political opponent, nor was she a political commentator, routinely engaged in criticizing candidates, Zervos' attorneys countered in a court filing last month. She came forward to report the details of defendant's unwanted sexual battery only after he repeatedly lied publicly about his behavior. Defendants then used his international bully pulpit to violate her for a second time. So more about Donald Trump and his alleged sexual assault of women. There are other women, too, that are claiming that Donald Trump made unwanted sexual advances towards them. So we could talk about that. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. A key moderate Republican is urging President Trump to support a bipartisan Senate effort to reinstate payments to health insurance companies. Senator Susan Collins says Trump's move to halt the subsidies poses an immediate threat to millions of Americans who now face rising premiums and lost health care coverage. The insurer payments will be stopped beginning next week. And President Trump's chief economist says the administration's plan to cut corporate tax rates will cause average household incomes to jump by $4,000 a year. That's a stunning 5% increase in household income that could be met with skepticism among tax experts and Democratic lawmakers. The analysis is by Kevin Hassett, who's chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. His analysis argues that a large amount of savings from trimming the corporate tax rate to 20%, down from 35%, would flow to workers and not to investors. However, separate studies, including a 2012 Treasury Department analysis, suggest the clear majority of any savings would go to investors and would be unlikely to push up wages for workers, as the administration claims. Florida communities cleaning up and making repairs after Hurricane Irma are expecting the U.S. government to reimburse their costs. But an investigative report by the Associated Press shows the Federal Emergency Management Agency may take years to pay those bills if it pays up at all. Dozens of requests for reimbursement from FEMA are still pending, including at least three cases in Florida that have been pending for more than 10 years. Well, a small number of police departments are showing interest in a new type of video camera that can be mounted directly on officers' guns. They say it may offer a better view of officer-involved shootings than body cams. But some law enforcement officials and civil rights groups note that gun cameras start recording only after weapons are drawn and won't capture what led up to the confrontation. Proponents say police officers' arms, walls, and other objects can get in the way of body cameras. They also say body cameras may not be turned on. Police in St. Petersburg are among those considering gun cameras. Manufacturers say many other departments are showing interest in gun cameras as well. And there was a man arrested in Orlando after police mistook donut glaze in his car for crystal meth. Has been given a payment by police of $37,500. Daniel Rushing told the Orlando Sentinel that he received the settlement check last week from the city of Orlando. Rushing was arrested in December of 2015 when a corporal spotted flakes of donut glaze on his car's floorboard, and the corporal thought that they were pieces of crystal methamphetamine. Now, the man who was stopped by the police, Rushing, told officers it was likely sugar from a Krispy Kreme donut that he had just eaten, but roadside drug tests showed positive for crystal meth. Later, a state crime lab test cleared Rushing. This is weeks later. So he filed a lawsuit, and last week he got a check from the city of Orlando for $37,500. Here's our phone number, 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org, and let's see what's on folks' minds. We're going to go to Kevin first in Bradenton. Hey, Kevin, you're on MNF. What's on your mind?
Hey, Rob. I don't know if anybody saw the 60 Minutes last night about the amount of people that have died from the pain pill overdoses and such over the last few years. Like 200,000 people, I think, in the last decade. And I found it interesting, unfortunately, that the DEA had fined the distributors over $300 million. And then it went on to say that because of the revolving door between government and private sector, the lawyers that left the DEA were then hired by these companies, and they basically slowed down these are big Fortune 500 companies that are the actual distributors, and it slowed down these fines. And, you know, just also to point out, one of the things they showed was that one county in West Virginia that had a population of 25,000 received over 11 million of these pills in a five-year period. And my point, the reason I wanted to bring it up today was because, you know, this whole corporate tax rate cut is going to go to corporations like this, and they're going to use this money to do things just like this. And I don't know why this isn't a bigger issue. I mean, if 200,000 people had been killed by a terrorist or terrorist attacks in this country, you'd think it would get some attention. But when it's drug companies, and these distributors, by the way, these were suspicious orders by obviously, you know, pill pushing little, you know, pharmacies that sprang up to take advantage and to make money. So it's all about money. They could give a damn about people's lives. And I, for one, I have, you know, personal friends that aren't here anymore because of these types of abuses. And, I don't know. I just wanted to bring light to that, and I wasn't sure if you were aware of it.
You know, I made the mistake of watching a football game yesterday, so I missed the 60 Minutes piece. But since I got into work this morning, everybody's been calling the station saying that we should do something about this. And, you know, people told me one of the takeaways is that one of the people behind this collusion between the drug industry and Congress, one of the people behind this collusion is now the head of drug enforcement. Is that right? Is that one
of
the takeaways?
I think it is, but I didn't actually, I recorded it and then I went to sleep, so I didn't finish it because I was like you watching football. But I think that it's really obvious that the one part I did watch, the first half hour, so they were saying that the whole reason that the fines slowed down, I mean, they were initially treating these companies almost like, you know, they were looking at a drug cartel. And then the Justice Department came down on these DEA employees, which obviously they were being influenced by money. So, yes, I'm sure that that guy, you know, that they're talking about the fact that the money in these companies is so large that to say that they're not influencing policy is ridiculous. And my point is that 200,000 people, 200,000 Americans have died from drug overdoses. And why isn't there more of an outrage about this? I think that this is not fake news. This is an example of people's attention being constantly diverted to things that they may seem important, you know, but ultimately, if you knew people like I did, young people that were good people that may have just, you know, been at a party and took, you know, something that they didn't know was going to wind up putting them to sleep forever, it has a bigger effect on those of us that have actually had, you know, personal experiences with these types of things. So I don't know.
Kevin, I'm going to play the opening of the 60 Minutes piece, and we'll just hear the first 2 or 3 minutes of it. But before we go, before we let you go, tell us about one of your friends. You said that these are young people that...
Actually, it was a best friend of mine, him and his wife, and the youngest son had been in an accident where he had rolled his SUV, unfortunately, and so he had broken his neck. And he was in a halo for a long, long time. And while he was experiencing that pain, he basically became addicted to these pain pills. So then after he gets out of the halo and he's, you know, trying to live a normal life, he's still taking them. And then one night at a party, apparently with a lot of alcohol, I mean, he was 20 years old. He was just a wonderful, used to love reggae music, just a wonderful kid. And, you know, he ingested a pill. Maybe he had had more than one in the day. But it wasn't like he was some kind of a heroin addict, which, hey, I'm not trying to slam them either. You know, I'm just saying that this is an example of somebody that was, in a way, you know, through no fault of his own, because he became addicted to these because they were available to help him treat the pain from the auto accident. And then 10 years later, his oldest brother, another, you know, young person that I knew, he had some substance abuse issues, but he died from an intentional, both of these accidental overdose.
Mm. Well, Kevin, yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks. We got to do something on it. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank
All right.
You,
I'm sorry about your friends. Let's listen into what was a major investigation last night by CBS and the Washington Post. I think there's a front page story in the Washington Post today, but this took up most of the CBS broadcast last night. We're not going to hear the whole thing, but you can find it at the CBS.com or CBSNews.com website. We'll hear the opening 2 or 3 minutes. Bill Whitaker is the reporter.
In the midst of the worst drug epidemic in American history, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration's ability to keep addictive opioids off U.S. streets was derailed. That, according to Joe Renacisi, one of the most important whistleblowers ever interviewed by 60 Minutes. Renacisi ran the DEA's Office of Diversion Control, the division that regulates and investigates the pharmaceutical industry. Now, in a joint investigation by 60 Minutes and the Washington Post, Renacisi tells the inside story of how, he says, the opioid crisis was allowed to spread, aided by Congress, lobbyists, and a drug distribution industry that shipped almost unchecked hundreds of millions of pills to rogue pharmacies and pain clinics, providing the rocket fuel for a crisis that over the last two decades has claimed 200,000 lives.
The story will continue in a moment.
Well, of course, I've got to put a commercial, embed a commercial. So we'll talk over the commercial for a second, and then, or the commercial probably will run longer than that. And then we'll get back to Bill Whitaker's story. Let me just read the headline. It says, ex-DEA agent, opioid crisis fueled by drug industry and Congress. And we're just about Just a few seconds away from hearing the next part of the major CBS investigation and Washington Post investigation from last night. So hang in there. And we're going to take some phone calls, too, at 813-239-9663. You are listening to WMNF in Tampa. This is Radioactivity. And we're going to go back to more of this CBS documentary in just a moment. We're getting a lot of emails, too. You can send your email comment in to us here at dj@wmnf.org. We've got five or six that we'll read right after this.
This is an industry that's out of control. What they want to do is do what they want to do and not worry about what the law is. And if they don't follow the law in drug supply, people die. That's just it. People die.
Joe Renesisi is a tough, blunt former DEA deputy assistant administrator with a law degree, a pharmacy degree, and a smoldering rage at the unrelenting death toll from opioids. His greatest ire is reserved for the distributors, some of them multi-billion dollar Fortune 500 companies. They are the middlemen that ship the pain pills from manufacturers like Purdue Pharma and Johnson & Johnson to drugstores all over the country. Renesisi accuses the distributors of fueling the opioid epidemic by turning a blind eye to pain pills being diverted to illicit use.
This is an industry that allowed millions and millions of drugs to go into bad pharmacies and doctor's offices that distributed them out to people who had no legitimate need for those drugs.
Who are these distributors?
The three largest distributors are Cardinal Health, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen. They control probably 85 or 90% of the drugs going downstream.
You know the implication of what you're saying, that these big companies knew that they were pumping drugs into American communities that were killing people.
That's not an implication, that's a fact. That's exactly what they did.
In the late 1990s, opioids like oxycodone and hydrocodone became a routine medical treatment for chronic pain. Drug companies assured doctors and congressional investigators, as in this 2001 hearing, that the pain medications were effective and safe.
Addiction is not common. Addiction is rare in the pain patient who's properly managed.
With many doctors convinced the drugs posed few risks, prescriptions skyrocketed, and so did addiction. Many people who had become addicted to painkillers turned to shady pill mills, pain clinics with rogue doctors to write fraudulent prescriptions, and complicit pharmacists to fill them. One-stop shopping for controlled narcotics.
Well, that's the opening to a 60 Minutes piece of major investigation last night. The headline is XDE Agent, Opioid Crisis Fueled by Drug Industry and Congress. So you can watch that at the CBSNews.com website. You can watch the whole thing. It's about a half an hour long. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, and you can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Mike, who's in Tampa. Hey, Mike, what would you like to comment about?
Yes, Rob, on that 60 Minutes episode is very good. And the way it concluded, if I recall, it was a bill that was sponsored by two Republican congressmen, Republican Marino and then Coburn from Texas, eventually went through Congress with no opposition whatsoever. And it really dismantled or really harmed DEA's ability to go after these things and litigate. And it turns out, yes, Representative Marino has been nominated, I believe, to be the new drug czar under the Trump administration. But wow. It's in that story.
Wow. All right, well, I'm going to have to pay attention. And the vote in the Senate, if I recall right, was 100 to zip, right? It was unanimous, both Republicans.
Yeah, I guess they call it consensus. If they're by consensus, this will pass.
Right.
And Obama signed it. There was no opposition whatsoever, either the House or the Senate. So, yeah, Big Pharma really worked hard on that one.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks a lot. Thanks for your...
You bet.
All right. So I did not see the piece. I will watch it when I get off the air. We're getting other emails, too. People are calling about sexual harassment. This person says, Why can we deal so swiftly and justly with Harvey Weinstein's sexual assault allegations and not Donald Trump's as well? I'm astonished that Donald Trump is getting away with his crimes. That's an anonymous from 865 area code. David writes this: I'm pretty disappointed with the state of Florida for the lousy job they're doing with distributing temporary EBT benefits for Irma relief, as shown on local TV. The lines this past weekend in Lakeland were so bad and so disorganized that people were turned away empty-handed at noon on Saturday. These are folks standing in line for food, for a food card, I guess. And then David goes on to write, I don't understand why the Polk County and Hillsborough County sites were so close together. Plant City and Lakeland are only a few miles apart. Why not put both disbursement locations in the center of the counties? And why were both so disorganized? There should have been much better city, county, and state cooperation to help with the traffic and the people jams. Why not add a second location in both counties like Broward County had? The state of Florida and Rick Scott dropped the ball on this. So, David, thanks for that. We're getting emails, too, and donations. Our fund drive just ended, and we raised the $235,000 that we needed to get through the next 4 months. You can always make a contribution to WMNF. It's always greatly appreciated, and I see a bunch of people have made emails online this morning at WMNF.org. Several of them want to remain anonymous, so that's fine. But thank you for your contribution. That really helps us out and shortens future fund drives this year in the fiscal year. Our fiscal year is October 1 through September 30th. So we're in our new fiscal year, just began a few days ago. James writes this: I take pain meds because my body is wore out after 40 years of hard work. I hope people like myself don't get caught up in this crisis, writes James. James, that's the flip side of this, too, that people should have access to pain medication when they need it. I think that's, I agree with that. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Debbie, who's in Tampa. Hi, Debbie. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to say?
Hi, I'm calling about the opioid crisis discussion you were having.
Right.
My brother up in Jacksonville just 2 weeks ago was in a fairly serious car accident. He wound up with some bruised ribs. But the emergency room doctors gave him a prescription, which he did not fill. We checked it online before he did anything, for a Percocet 10. We'd never heard of it. My brother, who is not on any pain meds at all and has very little tolerance for pain medications, this Percocet 10 is equivalent of 4 of the regular Percocet.
Wow.
And that's what they were starting him with.
Wow.
It's the medical profession and what they're prescribing without thought that is a big contributor.
Yeah. Well, it's hairy. Well, Debbie, thanks a lot. You know, I had some dental work done a couple of years ago, and they gave me oxycodone, and they said take that, and I didn't take it. I've still got the. I probably should throw out the the bottle, but I was so afraid of getting hooked on an opiate that I didn't take it.
I don't understand what's wrong with the old Tylenol 3 codeine things that they used to give us. That was simple. I never knew of anybody who got addicted to it.
Yeah, and then if the lower level pain medications don't work, then maybe have the doctor increase it. But don't start at the top like your brother.
Exactly. Yeah. That was crazy.
Debbie, thanks a lot. How's your brother doing?
He's sore.
Okay.
But he's doing okay. He didn't fill the prescription.
All right, Debbie, thanks. Thanks for adding.
Thank you.
That really adds to the conversation. Thank you. 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. And you are listening to the Bay Area's community radio station. And let's go to Sam in Tampa. Hi, Sam, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, how you doing, sir? I'm just going to say, man, I own a local glass company in Tampa, and I was doing some work for a really, really sketchy pharmacy, man. And just to kind of, like, add on to what you were saying, you know, the owners of the actual pharmacy were the people running the show. And out of the 6 days that I was there installing glass, you know what I mean, cutting, fabricating, doing my job, you know, not once did I see one pharmacist in this pharmacy. You know what I mean? So that, for me, kind of, like, sketched me out. And then when I heard you say that, you know, CBS did a story of it, I was like, oh, my God. Like, you know, when you have a thought and, like, you know, you just keep thinking, and then all of a sudden somebody out of nowhere comes and reassures that thought.
Yeah,
that's...
And, Sam, did you see a lot of people bringing in prescriptions to be filled?
Man, I only saw addicts, man. It was very... very, very sad.
Wow.
Only addicts, man. Yeah, and the business owners were mad at the two drug dealers that were selling drugs outside.
All right, Sam.
Full mess.
Yeah, it is. Sam, thanks a lot. Thanks.
You're welcome, Mike.
All right, good to hear from you. Looks like we're out of time. I don't know if I can squeeze in any more phone calls or emails. But thanks a lot for listening. Be sure to stay tuned because we've got a great talk by Chris Hedges. That's coming up in the next hour. Sean Canan is on vacation, and he's going to be back next Monday with his Midpoint program. And then stick around for Executive Session, which is the program that comes up today at 1 o'clock. And you're always welcome to email into the studio at dj@wmnf.org, or you can comment about this show by calling 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115.